productive tasks are at the beginning of the day, the tasks where you should be investing the predominance of your time, attention, and energy. This will give you something to focus on throughout the day so you can work smarter instead of just harder. The challenge here is simple. Try the rule of three tomorrow morning. To accomplish more and spend time on your highest impact tasks, you have to act on them on a daily basis. Before you open up your email or start your day tomorrow, simply sit down with a pen and paper, mentally fast forward to the end of the day, and write down the three main things you want to have accomplished when the day is done. Fighting the urge to check your email is tough, but it's worth resisting so you can step back to have a clear mind while you think about what's important to you. If you have trouble thinking in terms of things you will accomplish, J.D. Meyer recommends you think in terms of, quote, wins, achievements, or highlights, like having a milestone on a project, clearing out your backlog of things to do, or winning over a customer. I also find it helpful to look through my calendar to see what meetings and commitments I have coming up, so I can get a good handle on how much time, attention, and energy I'll have to work with. Becoming more productive is a process of understanding your constraints, and observing how much time, attention, and energy you have will help you adjust accordingly. In the very next chapter, I'll guide you through accounting for all three ingredients of productivity in more detail. If you want to ramp up the rule even further, here are a few simple suggestions. Think about when, where, and how you're going to accomplish each item throughout the day. Studies show this makes acting out the goal easier and more automatic, and that it's especially helpful for carrying out unpleasant tasks. In addition to deciding on the three main things you want to accomplish, select other small tasks you intend to accomplish over the course of the day. The three things you intend to accomplish may be your primary focuses for the day, but there will almost definitely be other smaller tasks you need to accomplish too. Keep in mind your constraints. Start with just the daily ritual. Once you feel how effective the rule of three is over the course of the day, you'll jump at the chance to use it on a weekly basis too. Trust me on this one. When planning, keep your highest impact tasks in the back of your mind. And if you decide to try the rule in your personal life, which is worth a shot, especially when you have a lot of personal goals, keep in mind how connected your three accomplishments are with your values. Set two alarms during your workday. When they go off, ask yourself, do you remember what your three daily goals are? Do you remember your three weekly goals? If you do, are you on track to achieve them? At the end of the day and week, reflect on how realistic your three accomplishments were. Were they too small and did you overshoot them? Or were they too large and intimidating? Did you have a good understanding of how much time, attention, and energy you would have to accomplish the three items? Reflecting on how realistic you were will let the rule help you more and more over time. When your aim is to work more deliberately and accomplish more over the course of the day, the rule of three is in a league of its own. Chapter 4. Ready for Prime Time. Takeaway. When you take the time to observe how your energy fluctuates over the course of the day, you can work on your highest impact tasks during your biological prime time, when you're able to bring the most energy and focus to them. In a similar way, tracking how you spend your time over a week will let you see how intelligently you use your time and how well you focus throughout the day. If identifying your highest impact tasks and your daily focus were enough to become perfectly productive, this audiobook could end right here. But our story is just getting started, and not only because I have an 80,000 word count to hit. It's because despite our best intentions to work on the right things, we don't, for countless reasons. All these reasons involve either how you spend your time, attention, or energy. And I definitely don't count myself out of this group. Almost every day I waste time, become distracted, have trouble focusing, and feel low on energy. Thanks to my research and practice, I may be better than most, but I would be lying if I said I was perfectly productive, and so would any other productivity expert out there. Chances are you're in the same boat. Despite your best intentions, you don't have as much time, energy, or attention as you would like. Or perhaps you procrastinate, part two of the book, spend too much time on low-impact tasks that get thrown your way, part three, don't spend your time intelligently, part 4, feel overwhelmed, part 5, are constantly distracted and can't focus, part 6, or don't properly cultivate how much energy you have, part 7. From what I've experienced, this is perfectly normal. Throughout the rest of the audiobook, I'll provide you with the absolute best ways I've uncovered to better manage your time, attention, and energy. But before you learn to better manage the three ingredients of productivity, it's essential that you establish one final important piece of groundwork and take stock of how well you manage your time, attention, and energy already. The following two productivity experiments measured how I managed my time, attention, and energy. They produced valuable intel into how I was doing. One experiment measured my energy over the course of the day, and another diligently tracked how I spent my time and attention. Your biological prime time. As you may already be aware, your energy levels can fluctuate quite a bit over the course of the day. If you're an early bird, you have more energy early in the morning. If you're a night owl, you have more energy late at night. After you drink a coffee, you may feel a sudden energy boost, and then an energy crash later on. And if you're like many people, your energy levels may crash in the early afternoon after your energy levels spike after a large lunch. I see energy as the fuel that you burn over the course of the day to become productive. As such, it's critically important that you manage your energy well. If you have no fuel in the tank to do good work, or you're burnt out because you don't cultivate your energy levels throughout the day by eating well or getting enough sleep, your productivity will plummet, regardless of how well you manage your time or attention. To get to the bottom of how my energy levels fluctuated over the course of a typical day during my project, I designed an experiment where I kept a log every hour of the day to assess how much energy I had for 3 weeks. During those weeks, I also did the following. I cut out all caffeine and alcohol from my diet. I ate as little sugar as possible. I ate small, frequent meals throughout the day for fuel. I woke up and fell asleep naturally, without setting an alarm. The reasoning behind this productivity experiment was simple. By tracking the natural ebbs and flows of my energy over the course of a few weeks, with as few stimulants as possible, I would get an accurate picture of how much energy I naturally had throughout the day. I would then be able to take steps to become more productive. For example, I would be able to work on my most important tasks when I naturally had the most energy, or take steps to increase my body's and brain's energy when my energy naturally dipped. Everyone is wired differently, and everyone has different energy patterns throughout the day, depending on how their biological clock is set. I wanted to get to the bottom of how my clock was set in this experiment. After 3 weeks of inputting how much energy I had every hour, an interesting pattern emerged. Every day between the hours of 10 a.m. to noon, and from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m., I had more energy than any other time of the day. Different experts refer to this high peak time period by different names, but my favorite is your biological prime time, BPT, a phrase coined by Sam Carpenter in his book Work the System. Taking the time to observe how your energy fluctuates over the course of the day, you can work on your highest impact tasks during your BPT, when you are able to bring the most energy and focus to them, and work on your lower impact tasks when your energy levels dip. The most productive people don't just manage their time well, they also manage their energy and attention well. Rearranging your day around when you have the most energy is one simple way to work smarter instead of just harder. Plus, research shows that your brain's prefrontal cortex, the part of your brain responsible for creative thinking, is the most active immediately after you wake up. That means that even if you're low on energy after you wake up, if you do a lot of creative work, you may want to consider working in the morning instead of when you have the most energy, focus, and motivation. To me, it also feels incredible to tackle your most important task at the beginning of the day because you'll feel unstoppable for the rest of the day. After determining my biological prime time, I began to rearrange what I worked on over the course of the day accordingly. Every day between the hours of 10 a.m. and noon and 5 and 8 p.m., I worked on my highest impact and most meaningful tasks. Conversely, when my energy levels dipped throughout the day, I worked on my lowest impact tasks or invested in a lasting energy boost, like drinking a cup of green tea, and took time to recharge. You may not have complete control over what you work on and when you work on it, but whenever you do, choosing the smartest time to work on your high and low impact tasks can make a huge difference in your productivity. For example, if you have the most energy at noon, why would you break for lunch then instead of waiting until you actually need to refuel? We'll do a deep dive into how to take advantage of when you have the most energy later on, but getting a handle on your body's natural rhythm is one of the best ways I've found to work smarter instead of just harder. Of course, your energy is just one of the three ingredients of productivity. Becoming aware of how intelligently you spend your time and attention is just as important. A day in your life. Although I've never been much of a procrastinator, I've always been a dawdler. Before taking a shower in the morning, I dawdle and tidy up things throughout the house. Before heading out the door to run errands, I often open up a book to read a few pages, snack a bit, or get lost in my thoughts. I don't waste a ton of time in general, and I almost always get done what I intend to get done, but I love punctuating my productivity with short bursts of dawdling throughout the day. Dawdling helps me decompress, transition from one activity to the next, and even come up with better ideas. Chapter 17. Sure, it frustrates the hell out of people around me. Virtually every woman in my life, including my mom, sister, and girlfriend, has at some point told me to, quote, quit my dawdling, but I love it. Much like calculating my biological prime time, tracking how I spent my time every hour for a week was simple in theory, but quite tedious in practice. To do so, I printed out a sheet of paper that looked much like an Excel spreadsheet, with a grid with the hours of the day in rows and the days of the week as columns. Before getting to the results of my time log, it's worth talking briefly about why keeping a time log is so powerful. I personally don't maintain a time log very often, largely because doing so takes so much effort. But every few months or so, I make an effort to track how I spend my time to see how intelligently I'm using what limited time I have. Of the three ingredients every day that will make you more productive, your time is the most limited. While there are a multitude of ways to get more focus and energy, there's no way to get more time. To spend your time more intelligently on your highest impact and most meaningful tasks, you have to be aware of how you're already spending your time so you can make adjustments. For example, you might value personal fitness and spirituality and yet spend 0 minutes over the course of the week on either one. Or you might decide that training your team is one of your most important work tasks and again, spend no time on the task throughout the week. Without becoming aware of how you currently spend your time, it's hard to reflect on whether you're acting in ways that match up with what your values and highest impact tasks are. Keeping a time log is a great way to find your starting point, your base level, to better access how often you work on your highest impact and most meaningful tasks. A time log is also a great way to determine how well you focus throughout the day. If you check in every hour to jot down what you're doing and find that you consistently put important things off, you may need to invest in battling procrastination, chapter 5, working out your attention muscle, chapter 18, or reducing the number of distractions around you, chapter 19. Laura Vanderkam, the time-taming author of I Know How She Does It and 168 Hours, You Have More Time Than You Think, says that keeping a time log is a very useful tool to get a map of how you're actually spending your time. Quote, it can seem like a tedious and boring task, but it can free up literally hours in your week, she told me. The key is to find a system that works for you. Naturally, since you're logging how you spend your time every hour, or half hour, or 15 minutes, keeping a time log also makes you accountable to yourself every hour, instead of holding yourself accountable at the end of the day when you reflect back on whether you accomplished what you intended to. Studies show that when you keep a food log, you double the amount of weight you lose. A similar effect happens after you begin to maintain a time log. Vanderkam usually records her time in 30-minute chunks every quarter, for about a week each time. She says it's important to pick a typical week to record and to use the method you're most comfortable with, whether it's a simple notebook, a spreadsheet on your computer, or a productivity app. Quote, even though this is a good tool for finding out where you're wasting time, It can also help you see that dreaded tasks you've been putting off actually don't take as long as you think, she says. This is good for getting past procrastination. I conducted my first time log halfway through my project, and I think you may be a bit surprised by the results. But before getting to that, it's time for one final challenge to help you lay the groundwork while you read the rest of the productivity project. The Prime Time Challenge. Estimated time to do the challenge? About 1 minute every hour for at least a week. Energy and focus required? 1 out of 10. Value? 9 out of 10. Fun? 3 out of 10. What you'll get out of it? An understanding of how well you manage the three ingredients of productivity, so you know your starting point and can make adjustments to get more done every day. The fourth challenge I have for you will pay for itself many times over. Track your energy to determine your biological prime time, and keep a time log to evaluate how well you manage your time and attention. Energy. If you want to truly observe your body's natural rhythms, before keeping a log of how much energy you have, you should, 1, cut out caffeine, alcohol, sugar, and as many other stimulants as possible from your diet. If it takes you a few days to adjust, you may want to consider throwing out your first few days' worth of data, because they may skew your results. 2, eat small, frequent meals throughout the day. And 3, if you can, wake up and fall asleep naturally without the aid of an alarm clock or smartphone. Cutting out caffeine and alcohol is probably the most difficult thing I'll ask you to do in one of these challenges. But to get a good measurement of when you naturally have the most energy, it's almost essential. I see drinking alcohol as a way of borrowing energy from tomorrow. And because you invariably crash after a caffeine high, drinking caffeine is a way of borrowing energy from later on in the day. To get a consistent reading on when you're naturally the most productive, you should cut both out for your measurements. And though sugar can serve as a temporary boost every once in a while, from an energy and productivity standpoint, it's not helpful in the long run. I personally recommend cutting out all three, starting a week before you start to track your energy levels. Your biological prime time doesn't change much over time, and the knowledge of when you naturally have the most energy will pay dividends for years to come. To track your energy levels, as well as your time, you simply need a sheet of paper that lists the hours of the day and the days of the week. To save you some time, I've put together a chart that has everything you need to track your time and energy levels for 1 week. Just head over to the website for this audiobook, productivityprojectbook.com/TPP, to download and print off the chart. Time. Every hour on the hour, in addition to noting how much energy you have on a scale of 1 to 10, make a note of 1, what you are doing, and 2, how many minutes you procrastinated over the hour, an estimate. Here are a few tips I think you will find helpful for this challenge. In addition to tracking how you spend your time with a pen and paper, if you work a lot of time on the computer, there are some great apps that will let you track how you spend your time there too. If you have the freedom to install programs on your work computer, I highly recommend Rescue Time, rescuetime.com. It's free for the Mac, PC, and Android. And Toggle, toggl.com. It's free for the PC, Mac, iPhone, and Android. Rescue Time tracks your time for you automatically in the background, and Toggle lets you track your time manually. If you find yourself procrastinating, don't worry, that's normal. According to the procrastination researchers I've interviewed, everybody procrastinates at times, including some of the most renowned procrastination researchers from around the world. Don't be too hard on yourself when you write down how long you procrastinate, and don't be afraid to be honest. If the thought of tracking your time and energy for a week or more puts you off, try tracking your time and energy for just a few days. Once you begin to observe some patterns, I think you'll be encouraged to pursue both further. Personally, I recommend tracking your time for a week and your energy levels for 2 to 3 weeks if you can. Tracking your time and energy is tedious, I'll grant you, but the return on both activities is huge. So much so that I still track both my time and energy every few months, even though, compared to my initial reading, the return is much smaller. I believe there is incredible value in this activity. This exercise might be, in itself, enough to motivate you to reduce the amount of time that you waste on low-impact tasks. But if it isn't, don't worry. The rest of this audiobook will guide you through some of the best ways I've discovered to better manage your time, attention, and energy. Now that we've laid the groundwork to becoming more productive, let me get to the one thing I've swept under the rug thus far in this audiobook. The results of my first time tracking experiment. Part 2. Wasting Time. Chapter 5. Cozying Up to Ugly Tasks. Takeaway. Procrastination is human. The biggest reason your highest impact tasks are so valuable is that they're often more intimidating. They almost always require more time, attention, and energy than your lower impact tasks. They're typically also more boring, frustrating, difficult, unstructured, and lacking in intrinsic rewards, which all act as triggers for procrastination. Wasting time. In October of 2013, after I conducted a productivity experiment around watching 296 TED Talks in a week, a staff member of the prestigious TED organization invited me to participate in an interview for its official blog. TED, which stands for Technology, Entertainment, and Design, is a worldwide series of conferences where leaders in all three fields gather together to talk about their ideas worth spreading. I was over the moon. I was about halfway into my year-long experiment. People were starting to discover my website, and the interview was a huge coup. Along with other TED luminaries like Bill Clinton, Malcolm Gladwell, Jane Goodall, and Bill Gates, I would be on the front page of TED.com. When my interview was posted a week later, I was excited all over again. My favorite part of it was the opening line, which read, "Chris Bailey might be the most productive man you'd ever hope to meet." TED thought I was the most productive man ever. That should go on the cover of my book, right? That same week, I tracked how I spent my time as an experiment. What I discovered was humbling. Over the course of the week, after tracking how I spent every hour of every day, including how much time I spent procrastinating, I discovered that I spent 19 hours on reading and research, 16.5 hours writing, 4 hours conducting and participating in interviews, 8.5 hours doing maintenance-type tasks, and 6 hours procrastinating. If you're curious, over those 5 days, I also spent 39.5 hours sleeping, 9 hours on household and personal tasks, 6 hours working out, 2.5 hours meditating, and 10.5 hours on leisure activities, mostly reading and spending time with friends. By pretty much any measure, my week was extraordinarily productive. TED organizers published their interview with me. I wrote 4,683 words, finished reading 2 books, and read countless articles on productivity. I also invested 37.5 hours into 2 of my highest impact tasks, and there were no gaps between what I intended to accomplish and what I actually accomplished. As the icing on the cake, I had a ton of energy and focus throughout that week. Yet I spent 6 hours putting off what I had intended to do, which didn't include the time I spent taking breaks. While I was excited to share what I learned in tracking my time, I ultimately decided against putting the results up on my blog. I'm revealing them for the first time here in this audiobook. I didn't often shy away from being vulnerable during my project, and always wrote about the times I failed, but this time my pride got in the way. It stubbornly prevented me from saying anything that would take away from my newfound identity as the world's most productive person. But as it turns out, procrastinating isn't something to be ashamed of. And here's why. Everyone procrastinates. One of the smartest decisions I made when I started a year of productivity was blogging every day about what I learned from my research and experiments. As more and more people began to follow my approach to exploring productivity, I was able to use this growing attention to dive even deeper into what it takes to become more productive, such as interviewing experts like Tim Pitchell. Tim Pitchell wrote the best-selling book, Solving the Procrastination Puzzle. He's been researching procrastination for more than 20 years. Tim walks with a spring in his step, exuding a zen-like calmness that's not unlike the meditators I've interviewed for this book. His personality and demeanor on the surface, seem incongruous with what one might expect out of one of the world's foremost authorities on procrastination. What Tim said during our first conversation set me more at ease than anything I had heard in a long time. Everyone procrastinates. Procrastination is simply human nature. Pierce Steele, the author of The Procrastination Equation, backs that up, explaining that, quote, across scores of surveys, about 95% of people admit to procrastinating, end quote. The other 5% are lying. Naturally, different people procrastinate in different ways and amounts every day. Research shows that about 20% of people procrastinate chronically. But whether or not you're a chronic procrastinator, you probably put things off more than you realize. My 6 hours over the course of a week may even be on the low end of the spectrum. According to a recent Salary.com survey, 31% of people openly admitted to wasting at least an hour every day, and 26% of people admitted to wasting 2 or more hours every day. And that's only the time employees consciously wasted. Depending on your work, you may procrastinate for more than 2 hours every day. Pitchell found in one of his studies that the average student procrastinates for a third of his or her waking hours. The 6 triggers of procrastination. The science behind why we procrastinate is simple. One of my favorite pieces of research on the topic, which Tim Pitchell also participated in, found that there are a handful of attributes a task can have that make you more likely to procrastinate on it. There are also personality traits that make you more likely to procrastinate, but I'll get to those in a bit. I personally prefer to focus on the tasks themselves, since a task is way easier to change than your personality. Plus, you're great. Don't ever change. It's actually relatively straightforward. Personality aside, the more aversive or unattractive a task or project is to you, the more likely you are to put it off. And there are 6 main task attributes that make procrastination more likely. Those are whether a task is one or more of the following: boring, frustrating, difficult, unstructured or ambiguous, lacking in personal meaning, or lacking in intrinsic rewards. It's not fun or engaging. The more of these attributes a task has, and the more intense these attributes are, the less attractive a task will be to you, and the more likely you'll procrastinate on it. This is why you put off some tasks to the very last moment, like doing your taxes, in favor of doing other tasks, like watching Netflix, which don't set off nearly as many triggers. Doing your taxes is one of the most boring, frustrating, difficult, and unstructured tasks there is. And if you're like me, you probably don't find it all that meaningful or fun. For most people, doing your taxes has all 6 procrastination triggers. Other commitments like visiting the doctor for a checkup, calling your mother, working from home, running a marathon, and writing a book also set off multiple procrastination triggers, which makes you more likely to put them off. It's important to think about why you're procrastinating. As Tim Pitchell put it, sometimes procrastination is just a symptom that your life just doesn't match up to what you're interested in, and maybe you should do something else. The reason you feel so much less mental resistance to watching Netflix than you do with doing your taxes is Netflix is far less boring, frustrating, and difficult, and it's more stimulating and structured. Netflix even shows a link to play the next episode of a series as you finish watching the current one. Because watching Netflix has almost no procrastination triggers, we don't put it off. The biggest reason your highest impact tasks are so valuable is that they too are aversive. They almost always require more time, attention, and energy than your lower impact tasks, and they're usually more boring, frustrating, difficult, unstructured, and lacking in intrinsic rewards. They're valuable and they're meaningful because they're hard, and that's why you get paid more than minimum wage to do them. This is a simple reality of not working in a factory. The more valuable your work, the more aversive it will be. This is also why becoming more productive can be so challenging. Although every single person on earth wants to get more done, accomplishing more involves taking on tasks that are more aversive. Procrastination gets in the way of accomplishing more since it is, in its simplest form, a gap between your intention and action. By the way, are you interested in gaining back 13.6 years of your life in an instant? Quit watching TV. According to Nielsen, the average American adult watches 5 hours and 4 minutes of television every single day. Assuming you live until 80 and start watching TV at 10, that adds up to 13.6 years of your life. Nerding out. Let's look at what happens inside your brain as you procrastinate. As you consider procrastinating on a task, a fascinating internal war rages on in your brain. Often you go from justifying why it's okay to watch one more episode of House of Cards to thinking about the fact that you need to do your taxes, from being tempted to check Facebook or Twitter one more time to thinking about how you really need to get started on your report that's due next Friday. This back and forth is the result of two parts of your brain, your limbic system and prefrontal cortex, going to war with each other. Your limbic system is the emotional, instinctual part of your brain that includes, among other things, your pleasure center. Evolutionarily speaking, the limbic is a very old part of your brain. Like an animal, it's what makes you instinctual and pushes you to give in to emotions and temptations. This is the part of your brain that tries to tempt you to put off doing your taxes to watch a few episodes of House of Cards. Your prefrontal cortex is the logical part of your brain that's fighting to get you to do your taxes. It's responsible for, among other things, logic, reason, and keeping your longer-term goals in mind. It's also what motivated you to pick up this audiobook. If you've done the productivity experiments I've mentioned so far, it's because your prefrontal cortex won out. If you've put them off and simply listened on, your limbic system won out. This back and forth between your emotional limbic system and logical prefrontal cortex is what leads to the decisions you make throughout the day. It's also what makes you human. If your prefrontal cortex won out 100% of the time, all your decisions would be perfectly logical, and you would be akin to a Vulcan from the Star Trek franchise, basing all your decisions on pure logic and reason without consideration of your emotions or the emotions of others. If your limbic system won out 100% of the time, you would be no different from an animal who makes every decision on instinct. In every decision we make, either our limbic system or our prefrontal cortex gains the upper hand. Our limbic system wins out when we go home with a cute girl at the bar, don't resist ordering a donut with our morning coffee, or when we procrastinate. Tim often refers to procrastination as, quote, giving in to feel good. And if you look at a brain scan of someone who is procrastinating, you'll see that on a neurological level, that's exactly what happens. The prefrontal cortex surrenders to the limbic system so that we can feel good in the short term. But our prefrontal cortex wins out a lot of the time too. It is the reason we set aside money for retirement, hit the gym after work to get into shape, overcome the 6 triggers of procrastination, and read about productivity. It's the part of your brain that is constantly fighting for you to achieve your long-term goals instead of the goals that are only pleasurable in the short term. And it is nearly impossible to become more productive without a strong prefrontal cortex. Whenever we think about whether we should work on an ugly task, our limbic system and prefrontal cortex battle it out, and then we either procrastinate or we tackle the dreaded task. But there's just one issue between this battle with the limbic system and prefrontal cortex. The deck is stacked. Regaining control over your brain. So far, I have painted a picture in which your limbic system and prefrontal cortex are in constant battle with each other. Although that's true as far as procrastination is concerned, the rest of the time the two systems work together in incredible ways. Since the two systems are responsible for both logic and emotion, they're jointly responsible for some of the most remarkable innovations known to humankind, including language, the printing press, the light bulb, the wheel, and the internet. Logic created the wheel, but out of a desire to create a better and more modern world. Plus, the first inventor of the wheel probably got some mad props from his bros and scored well with the ladies afterwards. But that's just based on my subjective guess and not on evolutionary science or psychology. The interplay of your prefrontal cortex and limbic system is also what lets you pursue things that are pleasurable, engaging, and meaningful, like learning to play the cello, saving to hike up the Inca Trail, climbing a mountain, volunteering, building strong relationships, or pursuing long-term goals and following your passion. The part of studying the brain that I find fascinating is that even though these types of battles occur in our brain thousands of times every day, we usually aren't aware of them. Just as 90% of an iceberg sits underwater, our mind is only able to consciously observe a fraction of what's going on in our brain. The rest is hidden within the depths of our unconsciousness. This is why productivity can be so powerful, because you can harness this power by combining the science of how you think and act with the intention of learning how to accomplish more. While our limbic system is essential, much of productivity has to do with building up a strong prefrontal cortex, one that can show your limbic system who's boss when it needs to, and smack down impulses like checking your email or Facebook one more time in favor of working on higher impact tasks. While we need to keep our limbic system happy, it is impossible to invest in our achievements, relationships, and values without a strong prefrontal cortex. But that's easier said than done. While the interplay between our prefrontal cortex and limbic system is what makes us human, our prefrontal cortex is also much weaker than our limbic system. The limbic system has evolved over millions of years, while the prefrontal cortex has been around for thousands. In the exact same way that the most productive people learn to step back from working on autopilot, the most productive people learn to use their prefrontal cortexes more than their limbic systems. Tilting the scale. I've designed this chapter to be a bit longer than the other ones for a very specific reason: to ignite your prefrontal cortex. As you're listening to these words, your prefrontal cortex is on fire, processing the meaning behind the words you're listening to right now while connecting them to what you already know. Igniting your prefrontal cortex is, conveniently, what you have to do to defeat your limbic system and work on your highest impact tasks. For me, although procrastinating for 6 hours in a given week is probably on the low end of the procrastination spectrum, I wanted to squeeze every ounce of productivity out of my time. I wanted to get that number as low as I possibly could. After I discovered the source of procrastination, my limbic system bullying my prefrontal cortex, I did all I could to give my prefrontal cortex the advantage the next time my limbic system tempted me to give in to feeling good. After you have identified your most important tasks and have formed an intention to work on them, you will procrastinate on them, even though you likely have a stronger prefrontal cortex than most. But there are several strategies that work wonders for turning the tables on procrastination. In fact, with enough forethought, it's entirely possible to make doing your taxes a task as sexy as watching an entire season of House of Cards. Extreme Makeover, Taxes Edition. Oh, look at the calendar. Your taxes are due in a month, and you haven't even thought about getting started on them. But they can wait until tomorrow, right? The moment you notice your mind having an internal debate about whether or not to work on a task, or you begin to notice yourself saying things like, I'll do them later, I just don't feel like it right now, or worst of all, I'll do them when I have more time, it's a signal that the task before you is an aversive task, and that you need to make doing it much more attractive. By the way, I have something quick to get off my chest here. I don't have time for that is the biggest excuse out there. When someone says they don't have time for something, what they're really saying is that a task isn't as important or attractive as whatever else they have on their plate. Every person gets 24 hours of time every day and gets to spend those 24 hours however he or she chooses. But I digress. Because doing taxes is such an aversive task, it has created the entire tax preparation industry, which in the United States alone employs an estimated 320,000 people. And it's no wonder. If completing your taxes were as simple as clicking a button, the industry wouldn't exist. According to Intuit, the makers of TurboTax, the software program that, among others, makes doing your taxes less boring, frustrating, difficult, and so on, quote, nearly a third of taxpayers procrastinate on filing their taxes. My method of choice for making my tax task less ugly is to hire someone to do them for me. Every year I hire a business to do my taxes, and for a couple $100 I basically buy back hours of my time and attention so I can level up and focus on higher impact tasks and projects. It's tax season right now. And instead of collecting receipts, crunching numbers, and figuring out what I can and can't write off under my business, I'm writing these words. But let's assume that hiring a business to do them for you is out, and you have to file them yourself on paper. Just thinking about doing your taxes, maybe your limbic system is resisting listening on or dreading these next few words. So let's make over doing your taxes so they're just as attractive as watching Netflix. By seeing what triggers procrastination and then making a plan to flip those triggers, doing your taxes becomes more attractive. If I found myself putting off doing my taxes, I might sit down and make a plan to change those triggers. For example, if the trigger is boring, I might go to my favorite cafe for an afternoon on Saturday to do my taxes over a fancy drink while doing some people watching. If it's frustrating, I might bring a book to the same cafe and set a timer on my phone to limit myself to working on my taxes for 30 minutes, and only work for longer if I'm on a roll and feel like going on. Difficult. I research the tax process to see what steps I need to follow and what paperwork I need to gather. Then I visit the cafe during my biological prime time when I'll naturally have more energy. Unstructured or ambiguous. I make a detailed plan for my research that has the very next steps I need to take to do them. If it's lacking in personal meaning, if I expect to get a refund, think about how much money I'll get back and make a list of the meaningful things I'll spend that money on. If it's lacking in intrinsic rewards, for every 15 minutes I spend on my taxes, I might set aside $2.50 to treat myself or reward myself in some meaningful way for reaching milestones. Okay, maybe doing your taxes will never be as sexy as watching Netflix, but I think we came close, right? Three more ways to regain control over your brain. Flipping a task's triggers tackles two birds with one stone. It simultaneously makes a task less aversive by disabling its procrastination triggers while it readies your prefrontal cortex to battle your brain's limbic system. If you need to give your prefrontal cortex an even bigger shove, here are three more ways to regain control and work on your most aversive tasks. 1. Create a procrastination list. It's actually possible to procrastinate productively. When you make a list of meaningful and high-impact tasks to do the next time you procrastinate, you can remain productive while your prefrontal cortex warms up. During my project, I often found myself putting off reading long, tedious research papers, so I made a procrastination list that included items like writing and sending important emails, organizing folders on my computer, and tracking expenses related to my project. I think it's also helpful to give yourself a choice between working on only two tasks, the task that you're tempted to procrastinate on, and another task that's high return. 2. List the costs. Listing every single cost of putting something off is one of my favorite ways to get my prefrontal cortex fired up. It's a simple tactic, but it gives you a much better shot at winning out. 3. Just get started. Note that I didn't say just do it. If you have a big, aversive task like cleaning your basement, simply get started on it. Try setting a timer for just 15 minutes, after which you will stop cleaning and begin to work on something else. If you feel like going on after you get started, by all means do. But if you don't worry about it. Every single time I have simply got started on something, even if just for a few minutes, tasks have rarely been as aversive as I had imagined. Rita Emmett, the author of The Procrastinator's Handbook, summed this up well in what she labeled Emmett's Law. The dread of doing a task uses up more time and energy than doing the task itself. Progress. Over the ensuing months, whenever I noticed myself trying to justify my way out of a task, I used that as a trigger to fire up my prefrontal cortex. According to Tim Pitchell, Procrastination is at its most fundamental level, quote, a visceral emotional reaction, end quote, to a task that sets off multiple procrastination triggers. Firing up your prefrontal cortex is the best way out. Since my first time log, I wanted to get to the bottom of how to waste less time every day, a tumultuous journey, but one that taught me a lot along the way. At the time of my most recent time log, I was in the middle of writing this book. Writing a book is a task that, for me, sets off even more procrastination triggers than my project did. It's one of the least structured and intrinsically rewarding tasks out there, especially for a business-minded guy like myself, and it can be insanely boring, frustrating, and difficult at times. But whenever I've been tempted to procrastinate writing this over the last several months, the first thing I did was fire up my prefrontal cortex. And it worked. Here's what my most recent time log looked like. 17.5 hours reading and research. 15 hours writing. 5.5 hours conducting and participating in interviews. 2.5 hours doing maintenance type tasks. And 1 hour procrastinating. Much better, to my relief. A part of me was tempted to write that I didn't procrastinate at all, and though that would have made for a better story to end this chapter with, it simply wouldn't be true. Sometimes our prefrontal cortex wins out. The flipping challenge. Time required, 6 minutes. Energy and focus required, 8 out of 10. Value, 8 out of 10. Fun, 7 out of 10. What you'll get out of it. The ugliest tasks in your work and personal life will become much more appealing, and you'll waste less time when you work on them. This will help you free up even more time for your highest impact and most meaningful tasks. If you want to become more productive, you simply have to work on your highest impact tasks more often. But when you do, you're also going to procrastinate more often, because the more averse of a task is to you, the more likely you'll put it off. The next time you notice yourself putting off a task, use that as a trigger to think hard about what procrastination triggers set you off. Then, write those triggers down and make a plan to flip them. And if you need to fire up your prefrontal cortex even further, create a procrastination list. List the cost of putting off the task, or simply get started on it. Ironically, the tasks that will make you the most productive are also the most aversive. Fighting the emotional urge you have to put them off can go a long way toward making you more productive. By the way, working on more aversive tasks is essential if you want to become more productive. Of course, if you constantly find yourself procrastinating, that may be a strong signal that you need to seek out a different job. Who wants to only work on stuff that's boring, frustrating, difficult, ambiguous, unstructured, and lacking in pleasure and meaning every day? Chapter 6. Meet yourself from the future. Takeaway. The more you see your future self, you only in the future, as a stranger, the more likely you are to give your future self the same workload that you would give a stranger and put things off to tomorrow. It's important to get in touch with your future self by doing things like sending a letter to future you, creating a future memory, or even downloading an app that will show you what you look like in the future. An awkward letter. About 1 week ago, I received a letter in the mail. Receiving an actual letter is odd itself, but to make things even odder, it was from myself. Here's the letter in its entirety, which I sent to myself 8 months ago. Hi, man. Right now, you're kind of at a crossroads, unsure of what career, money, life, and other choices to make. I'd like to fast forward several months to see how things turn out, not gonna lie. But right now, you're surrounded by 8 brand new friends, and you're happy, in the fray of uncertainty. Everything is good because you're surrounded by people you care for and that care for you. I'm not sure how things will be with Arden, I guess, pretty good at this rate. But you are happy to hear her voice today. I'm not sure how healthy you'll be, but right now you're in the best shape of your life. I'm also not sure, since a common theme here, how happy, positive, mindful, or anything else you'll be. But I guess that's the beauty of it all. It's a cliche, but you believe this. Happiness is nothing more than coming to terms with how things change. I hope you're happy and doing great. At this rate, I know you are. Love, Chris. For the last 5 years, I've volunteered for an organization named Camp Quality. Camp Quality is a worldwide charity that puts on week-long summer camps designed to help kids who suffer from cancer feel like kids again. Volunteers are paired up with a camper, and we hang out with them for a week, and every once in a while throughout the year. In addition to the week-long camps, the organization puts on a yearly 4-day leadership camp for teenagers who suffered from cancer when they were kids. The camp lets people like myself share what we've learned so the campers can navigate some of the teen experiences we've already gone through. One of the activities at last year's leadership camp, whether you were a camper or a volunteer, was to write a letter to your future self. Even though my letter is a little awkward to look back on, I still remember the activity being valuable for a very specific reason. We hardly ever think about our future selves. The difference between you and Taylor Swift. If you were to lie down in an fMRI machine, a machine that measures your brain activity by looking at changes in blood flow, and you thought about your future self and then thought about a total stranger, like Taylor Swift, you would notice something peculiar when you looked at the two scans. They wouldn't be all that different. Hal Hirschfield, a professor at UCLA's Anderson School of Management, has conducted this exact study and found that while the average participant's brain scan of his or her present self and a stranger's scan varied quite a bit, the participant's brain scan of his or her future self and a total stranger's scan were almost identical. This has a huge impact on your productivity. The more you see yourself like a stranger, the more likely you are to give your future self the same workload that you would give a stranger, and the more likely you are to put things off to tomorrow for your future self to do. Since you see yourself from the future as no different from a stranger, you also see her or him as less tired, busy, and more focused and disciplined than the version of you that's listening to this book. And while in some ways that will be true, particularly as you begin to implement the tactics in this audiobook, you'll obviously have a lot more in common with yourself today than with a total stranger. The more disconnected you are from your future self, the more likely you are to do things like give your future self more work than you would give your present self, agree to unproductive or pointless meetings far off in the future, keep 10 uninspiring documentaries around on your PVR that you'll get around to watching, continually transfer aversive tasks to tomorrow's to-do list, and save less money for retirement. If I asked if you wanted to sign up for a marathon that's 10 weeks from now, chances are you wouldn't agree to it. That would require a ton of work over the next several months to build up to running 26.2 miles. But if I asked if you wanted to sign up for a marathon that's 2.5 years from now, though you still may not agree, chances are you'll feel a lot less resistance to the idea. You're a lot more likely to be attracted to the grand idea of running a marathon than you are to think about what your future self will have to do to get there. Surprisingly, though our limbic system takes over when we procrastinate, the prefrontal cortex is responsible for us not taking our future selves into account when we make decisions. Getting in touch. To understand how we think about our future selves, Hal Hirschfield conducted a fascinating experiment. He teamed up with professional animators to set up a simulator that showed participants a live 3D model of what they will look like when they retire. If a student moved even slightly, opened his or her mouth to speak, or turned one way or another, the model did the exact same thing in real time. After Hirschfield asked students a bunch of questions in the simulator, he gave them a task. Allocate $1,000 between their present-day selves and for themselves at retirement. After the experiment, he discovered something remarkable. Students who stepped into the simulator saved more than twice as much for retirement than those who didn't. Quote, "It's so easy to commit your future self to things your current self wouldn't want to do," he says. We call this a planning fallacy. He explains that you have the best of intentions when you make commitments for your future self, but that your future self usually gets the short end of the stick. But it's part of our biological makeup. Quote, evolutionarily speaking, when you could be eaten by a lion at any moment, saving for the future doesn't make much sense, he says. But it's easier to travel through time and get in touch with your future self than you think. I've already revealed my favorite way to get in touch with my future self, through the rule of three. In the rule of three, your future self takes center stage. By mentally fast-forwarding to the end of the day and thinking about what you want to accomplish, you activate the planning centers in your prefrontal cortex while you also step into the shoes of your future self. And you do the same when you plan out your three accomplishments at the start of every week. After coming across Hirschfield's research, I conducted a number of experiments to get in touch with my future self. Here are my favorite three. 1. Fire up Aging Booth. While hiring a programmer to create a 3D virtual reality simulator is probably out of your price range, I personally love an app called Aging Booth, which transforms a picture of your face into what you will look like in several decades. There are also other apps like it, like Merrill Edge's web app that shows you a live avatar of what you'll look like at retirement. Go to faceretirement.merrilledge.com. Aging Booth is my favorite of them all, and it's available for both Android and iOS, and it's free. On the website for this book, productivityprojectbook.com, you can see what to expect out of the app. I framed a picture of myself that hangs above my computer in my office, where I see it every day. Visitors are usually freaked out. 2. Send a letter to your future self. Like the letter I wrote at camp, writing and sending a letter to yourself in the future is a great way to bridge the gap between you and your future self. I frequently use futureme.org to send emails to myself in the future, particularly when I see myself being unfair to future me. 3. Create a future memory. I'm not a fan of hocus-pocus visualizations, so I hope this doesn't sound like one. In her brilliant book, The Willpower Instinct, Kelly McGonigal recommends creating a memory of yourself in the future, like one where you don't put off a report you're procrastinating on, or one where you read 10 interesting books because you staved off the temptation of binge-watching 3 seasons of House of Cards on Netflix. Simply imagining a better, more productive version of yourself down the line has been shown to be enough to motivate you to act in ways that are helpful for your future self. By the way, at the end of most winters, I leave a $20 bill in my pocket, which I completely forget about until I reach into my winter coat pocket the next year. While it's important not to be unfair to your future self, one of the most awesome things you can do is treat your future self, whether that means saving for the future, saying no to eating pizza tonight, working out, learning calculus, putting on sunscreen, flossing, reading more, or leaving some money in your coat pocket to find 6 months later. You'll feel incredible later on. The time traveling challenge. Time required, 10 minutes. Energy and focus required, 4 out of 10. Value, 7 out of 10. Fun, 9 out of 10. What you'll get out of it? You'll become less likely to put things off until tomorrow, foisting them on your future self because you no longer see your future self as a stranger. When you put something off or waste time, you're almost always being unfair to your future self. Before you get in touch with your future self, it's worth pausing for a few seconds to think about how tight you two are in the first place. According to Hirschfield, everyone identifies differently with their future self. He calls how closely you identify with your future self continuity. Before getting in touch with your future self, ask yourself, on a scale of 0 to 10, how closely do you identify with future you? After you've identified where you fall, if you find yourself a bit estranged from your future self, invest in connecting with future you, either by downloading an app like Aging Booth, sending a letter to future you through a site like futureme.org, or if you're feeling particularly adventurous, by imagining your future self and creating a future memory. Trust me, you'll thank yourself later. Chapter 7. Why the Internet is Killing Your Productivity. Takeaway. The Internet can destroy your productivity if you're not careful. The best way I have found to prevent the internet from wasting my time has been to simply disconnect from it when working on a high-impact or ugly task, and to disconnect as much as possible throughout the day. After getting over the initial withdrawal, the calm and productivity you'll experience will be unlike anything else. Technology is freaking awesome. The very first productivity experiment I conducted during my project, which was also one of the most memorable ones, involved using my smartphone for just an hour a day for 3 months. Throughout the experiment, traveling around with a notepad in one pocket and my iPhone in the other, I meticulously noted whenever I used my phone, which usually happened in 15-minute chunks of time, so I wouldn't go over the hour limit. I love running experiments like this, where I remove an element from my work and observe how my routines, habits, and rituals are affected, because I can observe how different aspects of my work, like using my smartphone and constantly being connected, either help or hinder my productivity. While humans have evolved at quite a consistent rate over the last 2.5 million years, in the last couple of centuries, technology has progressed at a hugely accelerated rate. Moore's Law, which says that the number of transistors on a chip will double every 2 years, has held true for more than 50 years, and today's run-of-the-mill smartphone packs more punch into 200 grams than an entire multi-room supercomputer did just a few decades ago. And humanity has, of course, advanced alongside this revolution. While the average life expectancy throughout the world hovered at 25 years from 5000 BCE through 1820, after the Industrial Revolution, our life expectancy began accelerating. It now sits at 80 years in the United States. But I would argue that of all the technology we have, the internet has changed our life the most. The internet, along with the technology it has inspired, has flattened the world and connected more people than anything that came before it. Plus, when you tap your smartphone a very specific